Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Gareth, thanks again for joining us.
Pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I qualified as an accountant with Arthur Andersen back in the 1990s. I was working in corporate recovery rather than straight audit. I came in through an American bank called DLJ. I came into the city covering the pan-European chemical sector. So it was a great place to learn.
So you went from accountancy to...
Correct. I came in, this was in the late 90s, I came into to equity research. And it was a great place to learn, but the excitement of the technology sector was there. This was 1999, 2000. And so I went to work for ABN AMRO, covering the internet sector as it was then known, in the very beginning of the year 2000, just before the dot-com boom. Following on from that, I went to Investec, the Henderson Crosthwaite, as the business was known at the time, to cover the TMT space and ended up running the technology research team there. And then later into the 2000s, I was appointed joint head of research for Investec, so responsible for the European research product. We had a team of about 30 analysts across 14 or 15 sectors. But I very much enjoyed the small mid-cap space. And at that time, Investec was heading towards larger cap coverage. And I wanted to join a team which was very focused on the smaller end of the market and some of the exciting opportunities which I think were there. So I joined Canaccord and helped them build out and expand their technology franchise and that a part of their business. Then in 2012, I began to wonder if there was a different way to do this. And there was a theme that there seemed to be an opportunity to help smaller or mid-sized businesses get their message across more effectively. I'd love to say that I saw MiFID II coming and everything that came with that. The reality was I just saw a number of companies struggling to get their stories across and an ability perhaps to apply really high quality research from analysts who were getting steadily more disenchanted with the bulge bracket or other big banks where they were working. Applying that great resource at the small mid-cap universe looked like a great opportunity, and so that's when I set up Progressive.
Before we go into the role of an analyst, can we just get the perspective of what a broker is, or a bank, how it sees its analyst function, both from a business perspective and from a practical perspective?
Sure, it's quite a difficult balancing act in many ways, because analysts in their own role as researchers and the bank more generally in its capacity as running a research department, you have to try and balance. On the one hand, you want to build a sort of ivory tower of knowledge and a great industry perspective or a market position or a franchise, a personal franchise or a bank's franchise, with regard to knowledge around a particular sector or a group of stocks. On the other hand, you need to be commercial and try and turn that into money for the bank and then for the analyst personally. And most of the role is I think most of the skill in the role is trying to balance those two things. Sometimes you spend a lot of time learning about an industry or building sector knowledge, for which there's really no short-term benefit. There's no real financial reward in the short term, either to the analyst or to the bank. But long term, if you build an honest, well-regarded franchise in an area of the market which is lucrative, that's a fantastic business to have. And that's both from the analyst personally and the broker, the bank. And so in many ways, their interests are aligned, but it's all about that balance between those two things.
And will you get certain brokers specialising in certain areas?
Yeah, there are some areas which are so exciting and so sort of continually driving of revenue and opportunity that almost all banks are interested in them. So TMT is an obvious example. Other brokers take more niche positions or become real specialists in things like resources or healthcare. And they're more sector focused and specialist, and some banks do those very well. But you're right, I mean, generally a bank will either try and be a focused niche specialist and expert, or will go for waterfront coverage and try and build individually strong franchises across as many different sectors as you can.
So what's a typical day for an analyst?
So the day starts quite early. RNSs start coming on the screen at 7 a.m. and analysts are expected to be at the desk just before 7, so they're ready for that. Because the problem is you really don't know what's coming. Where your house broker to a stock, often the analyst will be aware of, they will have been brought over the Chinese wall the evening before, so you know what's coming for those. But across your sector, you really don't know what's going to happen until 7 o'clock or 7:01 as you start to see the news coming through. So, and that really determines the course of the day. The analyst is normally sitting there at 7, sees the news, and they're normally required to give their sales desk some kind of summary or review of what comes out at 7 on the broker or the bank's morning meeting, which are generally 7:25 or 7:30, something like that. So you have half an hour of very intense analysis of what's come through on the news, dealing with any sort of obvious questions that might arise, and then trying to summarise that down into a succinct view or a concise summary for the sales team within about 25 or 30 minutes. So that's a very sort of high pressure, high activity part of the day, unless there's no news, in which case there's very little to do. So it's quite, you don't really know what you're going to get.
So are you covering the whole market, or do you cover sector specific, or sort of FTSE 100, FTSE 250, small cap?
Sure. So within the large cap area of the market, almost all analysts will be sector specific. So most analysts will have a particular group of stocks on which they're looking for the news. So if you're a telecoms analyst, you're looking at BT and Vodafone and some of the big European players. But each analyst will have a very sector-focused approach to looking at that day's news. Further down in the small cap space, you do see a number of analysts who are more generalist, and generally they're looking at their house, their corporate broking relationships. So they're more likely to know the news that the evening before, because they'll have been made inside on that. So they generally have a better view on what's coming, albeit they're required to think more broadly across a wider range of sectors. So you have analysts either very sector focused, but quite often not knowing what the news is going to hold, or more generalist, but they have a bit of an advantage because they often see the news the evening before.
And then what?
So you've seen the news, you've delivered your summary of it, or your views on it, and your response effectively at the morning meeting at say 7:30. That would run through till 7:40 or 7:45, depending on the size of the bank, the number of analysts, and the quantity of news that morning.
And it'll just be you delivering almost the news feed to them.
Yes, that's normally the analyst just talking through with some hastily prepared comments, trying to get the essence of that morning's RNS across to the sales team and the traders, because the market itself opens at 8, so it's important that they're aware and up to speed. Then you'll send that out, or you may have had to make a small written summary of that even in advance of the morning meeting, depending on the compliance structures. But that will then be disseminated out to the market, out to the investor clients, before 8 a.m, before the market opens. And after that, it's a matter of making sure that you're either talking to the fund managers, maybe talking to the company if there's some kind of surprise announcement you want to speak to management. Then, if it's a day where a company's got results, you might go to a 9:30 analyst briefing. And there's a fairly sort of formulaic approach to that. It's 9:30 in the morning, somewhere generally in the city, and the analysts for that particular sector, or who cover that particular stock, will all turn up to meet the company management team and learn a bit more about the results, going into a bit more detail. They're not allowed to receive any more company-specific or price-sensitive information at that briefing, but they get a bit more flesh on the bone, a bit more detail, and they can delve a bit deeper into some of the accounting treatments or some of the items which are of interest in that morning's RNS. So then the rest of the day, it really depends on really what's happened that morning. So if you had a big stock or a stock which is widely held among your investor client base, you might spend a lot of the rest of the day on the phone talking to those investors, describing to them your views on the news that you've seen this morning, updating them or giving them more detail following the analyst meeting if there's things that came out there that they might be interested in, or sometimes helping them prepare for their meeting, because often these investors, they'll be invested potentially across a very broad range of stocks. So often the analyst's role is helping the investor think about or focus on the three or four things that really matter to them for their meeting with the company. So you're almost helping them prepare their list of questions for their meeting with management, which might be that day or more likely a day or two further out. So you're working with the investors to help them get ready for that meeting.
And those investors are institutions?
Sorry, institutional investors, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. And then that's the rest of the day?
So that would be, if you had a big set of results from one of your major stocks and you were spending a lot of time talking to investors, that might take up the day. Had there been no news that morning, or if it was relatively small RNSs from companies without huge followings, then you're pretty much free to roam. You can look at any areas of the industry you've been thinking about. If you're working on a big note for a different company, spend some time on that. You might try and do a little bit of research into some aspect of an industry or something that you've been looking at. But it's very difficult to come up with an average or a typical day, because in some ways it's driven by literally what happens that morning. In other ways, it's much more about the areas into which you're trying to delve, or the sort of the long-term sector franchise you're trying to build. And analysts can be known, you know, you can spend days on end delving into a very niche, small part of an industry, which from a research management perspective is quite hard, because you don't know what these analysts are doing all day. Are they really doing anything at all? And is it productive? And so that's really the balance in terms of the broker and the analyst, is trying to make sure that the bank gives the analysts enough latitude to go and find interesting areas of sector knowledge or franchise enhancing value, which the bank can then benefit from, without giving the analysts so much latitude or sort of free rein that they can spend weeks or months looking at areas of a market for which there's no real long-term value, or there's no real benefit for the broker.
So for the analyst, how are you briefed? How does it work for you to work with the broker?
Most analysts are, well, once you've got a bit of experience, you're given a very broad remit by your employer. The banks understand that they're hiring or they're employing seasoned industry watchers or veterans of their industry in terms of research. And normally the head of research or the research management will give that analyst pretty broad leeway to focus on areas that are interesting to them. You will have an occasional franchise conversation. You might talk to your corporate financiers or corporate brokers about areas of the industry which are interesting, companies which are coming up which are exciting to you or to the franchise. And as a team, you might decide there are certain areas you want to sort of push into. And so there might be a lot of ivory tower or academic almost work pushing into those sorts of areas. But quite soon you'll want to focus that down onto individual companies, positioning of either management teams or the businesses that you're seeing day in, day out, and working to make sure that both you individually and the bank can benefit somehow from that knowledge, either by the value of your franchise and the investor feedback and the benefits that you get from the institutional investors just by helping convey knowledge and understanding about this area, or certainly in the small cap space, more often it's to do with individual company relationships and helping promote and float companies, or helping be their retained broker. And the analyst being involved in that sort of process normally helps the investment bank or the small broker win and retain relationships, and that's the way that the brokers make money.
So the relationship between the broker, the analyst and the company, who drives that relationship with the company? Is it the broker or is it the analyst?
The broker has, the corporate broker, the individual within the corporate broking or corporate finance department is the one that has the ability to be over the Chinese wall for a longer period of time. So they can be aware of a big strategic shift going on within a business, or a long-term M&A strategy, or certain things about the company to which the analyst is not privy and mustn't be privy. So that person will often have quite a strong relationship with the company management team, and they will be able to position and think about the sector franchise from that perspective. On the other hand, the analyst is probably the one that has more genuine and deeper understanding both of the industry and also of the institutional investor commentary and views around a sector. Because although in most banks there's a sales team through which the analyst knowledge or understanding is funneled and who help direct that effort, normally the analyst will be the one having an in-depth conversation with an institutional investor. So the analyst is in a very good position to bring together the investor sentiment or what investors are looking for, and relate that to the company's investment opportunities that they're seeing, either as a bank or a broker or as the individual analyst. And so that's why I like research so much, because it really gives you that potential to say, actually, what I'm seeing from investors is there's a lot of excitement in this particular area, and I'm meeting a number of unquoted companies perhaps who are looking at coming to market, or there's a large number of already listed companies who have different attributes and different aspects to their business. And trying to bring together those genuine business opportunities with the areas that investors are keen to explore and where they'd like to apply capital. That's what broking's all about, and that's really where research comes into its own, is bringing together those pools of capital with those individual investment opportunities. And I think good research is about marrying those two up in a consistent, reliable way. That's when it works well.
Can you talk a little bit more about your relationship as an analyst with both institutions or investors who are institutions and companies?
Sure. It's interesting because investors, some of them last a very long time as individuals. They can have careers that span decades. And the institutions for which they work, the fund managers, they tend to last as well. And of course, there have been changes, but some of the institutions that are the major investors in the UK market today are pretty much the same as they were 15 or 20 years ago. So that the fund management side is really quite stable and long-lasting. So building relationships with them is hugely valuable, and gaining reputation and trust with significant, high-performing, intelligent fund managers, that's a really important part of the research role. It's very valuable. On the other hand, companies, and there are some companies that have a long lifespan in the quoted universe, and you look at people at companies like Arm, Sage, or Aviva now, who have or were quoted for a long, long time. But quite often companies have a shorter duration than the investors who put money into them. And so you see companies come and go. Sometimes they're taken out very quickly if they're highly successful, hugely strong performance, and then they're bought at a huge premium. Other times they'll stumble and the share price will collapse and they'll be acquired or taken private at what might be a disappointingly low multiple, but they're gone from the public market. So companies, many of them come and go. Some of them last, but investors are the ones that tend to be around probably for the longest duration. So as an analyst, you're building long-term relationships with the fund managers who you expect to stay and for whom you're really working over a long time frame. And the way you're applying that, or the way you're doing that work, is to analyse and assess the stream of companies that come along. And some of those companies might last and might stay and might be great constituents of the UK market for many, many years. Others might be taken out in 6 or 12 months, and you see all of those. But that's the dynamic between the two.
So I thought that the broker, who's like the salesperson, would have the relationship with the institution and that trust would be built between them. But it's sounding as though the analyst is almost the linchpin and the broker just does the deal.
The brokers, the corporate brokers themselves, are involved in the deal making and the structuring of the deal, often on the other side of the Chinese wall in preparation for the process. The sales teams within the investment banks, the stockbrokers, they are the intermediary between the analyst and the investor. And the sales teams often will talk to fund managers across a range of sectors, or there might be salesmen who have a specific relationship with a particular fund manager or group of fund managers. And so often the salesman will be tasked with trying to work out which fund managers might be interested in a particular stock or a particular relationship. And then the analyst will be brought in to try and focus that down further, go and see the fund manager or the investor and work through and understand in a greater level of granularity what it is about this particular company that's attractive, why that investor is interested in that particular stock. So it's a sort of a three-way relationship between the corporate broker or the corporate financier, the sales team and the analyst. And each has an important part to play. And within that, the analyst's role is very much to be the sector expert, and in many ways the company detail expert as well. And that expertise is brought to bear either in a corporate transaction or some kind of fundraising or market activity, or through the daily sales calls to the institutions, getting the analyst in front of or talking over the phone to the right fund managers who might be interested in that particular stock.
So I've heard it said that an analyst will never write a sell note. Yeah. Is that true? I mean, I think I've sometimes seen a sell note.
Sure.
Could you give your perspective on it?
It's true, they are rare. There are very few sell notes written, and many brokers have to publish the proportion of recommendations in each category, so you can see how few there really are. Sell notes are rare in large part because they're relatively uneconomic for the analyst. If you think about an analyst trying to build a reputation, some analysts will try and build a reputation or an expertise around spotting the wrong and trying to find where things have gone wrong or companies who are either misleading the market or in a structurally very difficult place, and bring that to the attention of investors. And some analysts have done that quite successfully, and they will publish sell notes as part of that. Clearly, that brings you into conflict normally with the management team, who don't like a sell note, and they obviously will take issue with a lot of the things that you're saying. But also, and this is a slightly more difficult dynamic to think through, but it actually runs counter to what the analyst is trying to achieve more broadly, which is to build a good relationship with institutional investors. And so, and I've published the odd sell note over the years myself, the problem is the people that you're talking to about stocks across the sector are often also invested in that one stock where you publish a sell note. So you're talking to them for the rest of the week or the rest of the month about other shares that they own and describing what you think is good or bad about them and having a debate about the merits. But when you publish a sell note, it's really quite an aggressive thing. And often, especially if the share price falls, the people that own those shares will be upset that you've done it. They'll be frustrated, it'll cost, you know, they'll lose money. Mm-hmm. And so in that regard, it's actually negative for the analyst franchise to go in and crater or rubbish the shares that their institutional clients might be invested in. So in that sense, it can be a bit self-defeating. But there are some analysts who have built a good reputation for trying to ferret out misbehavior or, you know, wrongful practices in terms of accounting or revenue recognition, or just businesses that aren't really as well positioned as they pretend to be. And there is value in that, but I think the way research is currently rewarded and the way that commission structures are, and the way that especially in the small cap space, it's all about the corporate relationships, that means it's very hard for those sell recommendations to be worthwhile or to be rewarded. It's slightly more common in large cap, where you've got a significant commission flow from investors who, within the large cap universe, it's often not about whether you own or don't own a particular stock. It's all about weightings. So you might be underweight. You might still have, you know, a significant holding, but that might be underweight relative to your index weightings or whatever your benchmark might be. So in that world, having a reduce or a sell recommendation is more of a gentle steer up or down rather than a sort of an absolute red flag that we think that there's accounting fraud going on or something like that. So in the large cap universe, I think you do see more sell recommendations because the commission structure and now post-MiFID II, the payment for research, it's set up and it's sufficiently material to the analyst to reward sell recommendations. But in small cap, the economics don't really work like that.
And what happens when there's a conflict of interest? So you're the house broker for a certain company,
yeah,
which is very fairly valued. It's had bad news that's come out about it. What do you do about that?
Yeah. It is. I mean, it's always a conundrum, and as an analyst, you're trying to build or retain a relationship both with your fund manager, investor clients, but you're also very aware that your employer, the broker, is a retained corporate advisor or corporate broker to these small stocks. And that's the excitement, that's the balance of the objectivity and the independence of the analyst. And that's where really good research, I think, comes through, because you'd never want to hide from the difficulties. If you're trying to build a good long-term relationship with the investors, bearing in mind that they're the ones who will really last, it's those relationships that matter most to the analyst, then you don't want to hide from the bad news. You can't pretend it hasn't happened. The more intelligent approach is probably to say, okay, these are the challenges the company's facing. These are the problems which have come along. How is management responding? Is that a clever strategic response? Does it feel a bit like a knee-jerk reaction? Is this something that can be fixed, or is this a structural problem that's just not going to go away, and the business and its investors need to look for a different answer? So I think it's not all about the price target or the recommendation. Most analysts, I think, deliver most value when they're talking to institutional investors, talking them through the issues, discussing what's going on, and most importantly, putting that in the context of their knowledge, their pre-existing knowledge of both the company itself and the industry. And if you understand the business, you understand the sector that it sits in and the dynamics going on there, then as an analyst, I think you're quite well placed to talk investors through the way that they might want to respond. Maybe they should sell their shares, maybe they should buy more, and you won't be able to help guide them through that or inform that process unless you have those pre-existing bodies of knowledge. So that's really what the analyst's role is to have that knowledge and that understanding such that when surprises come along, and they often do, you're in a good position to help the investor community respond and assess and evaluate both the problems and the proposed response as quickly as possible. And often that's the real benefit of research.
And if you feel it's fundamental to the business model and you think that it is a sell, can you say that when it's a house stock?
You can. I have done it many years ago, and we lost.
Job.
I kept my job, and I kept my relationships with fund managers. We lost that corporate relationship.
Okay.
About a week later, there was a new broker appointed, and I'd obviously expected that was quite likely. The broker, my bank at the time, didn't interfere with my recommendation. They understood my reasons for doing it, and I published the sell recommendation. We lost the broking relationship, but more important to me and the bank was my reputation and theirs, and that really persists. As I was saying earlier, that's the long-lasting part of the role, is maintaining your reputation and integrity vis-a-vis the fund managers, and that's why it's such an interesting job, is that you're trying to balance that long-term relationship and reputation against the short-term opportunities around each corporate. And sometimes the answer is, you really do believe the stock's overvalued, and if you say so, there'll be short-term consequences, but long-term, if you're building and retaining that reputation, that's really where the value lies.
So coming on to MiFID II.
Sure.
What are your views on MiFID II, and how's it affecting the market?
So I think, first of all, it hasn't yet finished bedding down. There's still a lot of transition going on. A lot of brokers are adjusting their pricing structures or their models quite dramatically in some cases. And a lot of fund managers, where a lot of the administrative work is going on, they're also adjusting their models and trying to work through the way that they pay for research and how that's affected. There are also areas around investor access, roadshows, results meetings, and whether those count as inducements, whether they need to be paid for, if so, how much and by whom. So it's quite hard to see this is nowhere near a finish at this point. I think it's still a lot changing. I think, though, that what's clear is there was an expectation that certainly in the small mid-cap space, there would be downward effects or negative pressures in terms of the levels of research and the economics around writing research. And I think to an extent we have seen that. We haven't seen wholesale redundancies and removal of research teams, but what we have probably seen is a gradual attrition. Analysts maybe haven't been replaced as they leave institutions. Teams on average have probably slightly shrunk over time. And I think we are seeing slightly lower levels of attendance at company results meetings. So there's been a little bit of that showing through. But I do think it's still quite early days. And I think in many ways, MiFID II, to the extent it is a downward pressure on research, it's really just a continuation of a long-term structural trend. Research has been under pressure for reasons of economics and just of the industry dynamic for many, many years. That hasn't changed with MiFID II. Arguably, MiFID II has slightly accelerated or accentuated that, but it's just another move in the same direction.
Do you agree with the fundamental principles of MiFID II being brought in?
Oh, yes. I think the argument that institutional investors should trade at what's called best execution, so get the best price for shares or when they're buying or selling, trading at the best venue, you can't argue with that. That has to be the right way. And the theory that by allowing research to muddy those waters, the brokers were steering transactions towards their own trading books or their own entities rather than promoting best execution, I think that absolutely would have been the case. So, and you know, that was the broker's model, was you'd go and you'd talk to fund managers about your sector as an analyst or a salesperson, and you would try and persuade them, first of all, to buy or sell some shares, and then secondly, to buy or sell those shares through that broker. That was the way the model worked. And so it runs absolutely counter to best execution. So I think the tenets of MiFID II are absolutely right, trying to separate research and the payment for research from that buying and selling of shares and the commission that flows from it. That must be the right thing to do. However, and the FCA saw this coming and that they were very aware of it, the risk of the model that's been adopted is that it makes research for small mid-cap really quite uneconomic. And that's why I think we are seeing, you know, reduced levels of coverage and steadily slightly smaller teams. The FCA's comment in one of their early discussion drafts on this issue was essentially that was a price worth paying for getting large cap stocks and the lion's share of the market to trade more efficiently. And I think that's probably right. If you take a sort of a broad economic view of it, the value created by trading the FTSE 100 efficiently and smoothly without distortion, that's very significant. Mm-hmm. And the loss of value or the economic drag at the small mid-cap area is much less of an issue in terms of the broader economy. It's not a particularly big problem for the economy that there are a few analysts writing research on small cap stocks, that the world will carry on, things will be okay. But if people's pensions are almost entirely invested in the FTSE 100, as they probably are, and if those pensions are now less subject to artificially high levels of commission, or more importantly, trading at the wrong venue, which is much harder to spot as an investor in a pension fund or an investment trust, it's very difficult to tell if you're losing money by your fund or your fund manager trading at the wrong price, unless you go back and look at what price could my retirement pot have bought these Vodafone shares on a particular day. You'll never see it. It's a hidden cost. Mm. And so by splitting that out, making the investors pay for research clearly and overtly, I think there is significant benefit. And yes, in the small cap universe, there are some costs to that and there are some problems that it creates. But I think overall, you'd have to look at the economic pros and cons, and it does feel like it's the right answer, albeit that it causes some dislocation at the small end of the market cap scale.
So how do you see research going forward, particularly in the small caps area? ThinCap have now made their research publicly available, which is extraordinary. How do you see it playing out?
Yeah, I think you'll see a steady polarisation of a number of the brokers. Those whose product is of a certain type that they feel that they can be paid by the fund managers will continue to do that, and some banks and brokers are doing that more aggressively, and their view is that they will push to earn commission or to earn revenue from the fund manager community in the way that MiFID II sets out.
Who's been doing that most successfully?
Some of the bigger brokers have been doing that. The tier one or tier two banks are making quite a success of that, and it works out well because the bigger investors are prepared to pay. They don't want to be working with 20 or 30 small brokers, so they will focus their revenue and their payments on the bigger banks who can really drive high quality research and be paid money for that, and that's becoming economic. Outside of that, there will be smaller banks and smaller brokers who are focusing much more on the corporate world and are really pushing to get the research out on their house stocks, their brokership relationships. And if they can work through the compliance structures and make their research more broadly available, then that's what they'll do. And MiFID II has a particular exemption for research which is funded by the subject company. So in most cases, that's where you're the broker. And if there's a broker relationship that requires the research to be written, then that research can be distributed to all institutional investors as long as it's done at the same time on a sort of fair and concurrent basis.
Do you think us as retail investors will see a growing amount of research? Immediately MiFID II happened, there was no research, everything dried up.
Yeah.
Slowly there's been a trickle that's been coming through as people have worked out their strategy with it.
Yeah.
How do you think it'll play out?
Sure, I think there's a number of different factors here. On the one hand, some brokers will make their research more widely available. Other brokers, though, especially those who feel they can charge for that research, are saying actually they need to limit and severely restrict distribution, and there are more intelligent systems available for doing that. The era of PDFs being simply forwarded on, that's gone. You know, all of these things are now watermarked and logged and checked. So the bigger banks are being steadily more careful and more focused with their distribution. So that's becoming harder for the retail investor to find or to get in ways that they might have been able to do 2 or 5 years ago. So you've got some brokers which are going to make it harder to find their research. Others are more broadly available. But I think the main effect is really that overall the quantity of research that exists is in decline. And so that those are the different sort of different effects. So it's probably a company by company thing. If it's available for a particular company, then that's probably good for the retail investor. But depending on who the broker is and their relationship with that company, it might not be available at all.
And it has to be good for Progressive.
Well, so far, yes, we've seen good levels of demand. More and more companies are thinking about research. They're more aware of the distribution or the limits on distribution of the research from their house broker. And increasingly, companies they're unsurprised that there's a lack of following or coverage by a number of other brokers, because really, if you're not the retained house broker in the small cap universe, it isn't economic to cover a particular stock. It just doesn't work out from the analyst's perspective. And that's often been true historically. It's becoming more and more the case now. But most importantly, companies are aware of that. And so an increasing number of them are looking at other ways of getting research produced and trying to get high quality coverage of that stock out to as broad a universe as possible.
Gareth, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.